Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day there, Mark Kenny with ANU's Democracy Sausage for another week. And as usual, I'm joined by Dr. Maria Tafaga, political scientist extraordinaire from the School of Politics and International Relations, with which I'm also associated here at ANU. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you, Mark. I should get that on my business cards. Yeah, I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, extraordinaire. Yeah, well done. I think it's well deserved. Now, it's really interesting, isn't it? Hasn't been a very uplifting time in politics, I think it's fair to say, recently, as many people will have observed. But there have been some pluses as well. The legislation establishing a referendum has now passed the Senate. So we know that officially the nation is on track to a referendum later this year, in the last quarter of the year, as the PM describes it at the moment. So, of course, we eagerly await what the date will be. But sometime in October has been mooted. And at the weekend, the federal government also announced, out of nowhere really it seemed, $2 billion extra for affordable rental housing for the states. So that was kind of, I think, a bright moment in at the end of a week that had been particularly bad, I think, in Canberra. Yet that said, the Housing Australia Future Fund, which is this, you know, program announced by the government in the budget and which the Greens say is inadequate and therefore have been opposing, and the Liberals oppose on principle, that's been shunted off to October as well for a vote. It's a sort of like a quasi-rejection. There's mumbling from the government that this sets up a potential double dissolution trigger, and that seems to be a threat to the Greens, who'd suddenly find that all of their senators are all up for election all at once. The quota would be lower, of course, in a double D, wouldn't it?
It sure would.
So at one level, they might say, well, bring it on. But at another level, there's a sort of a, you know, they're at a high watermark at the moment, and there's a kind of a, you know, a mortality risk, I guess. Some senators may not be returned, and that's going to be...
No, I mean, I think the Greens have been really kind of interesting, like, politically around the housing stuff. They've sort of showed a level of maturity around negotiating on climate, right? Which I think is actually quite impressive, given that like, if you actually look at the configuration of that party room, it was not exactly easy for Adam Bandt to land that deal with his incoming members or his incoming senators, and just the sort of like the driving motivation of the Greens as a political force. And I think this is something we kind of discount a bit, but, you know, like a lot of Greens MPs, especially their leaders until quite recently, are literally people who were jailed for protecting the environment. Like, that is a very different worldview to someone like Adam Bandt, who's kind of come through a different career path and a different trajectory, who is a lot more what we would call materialistic. And I think a lot more pragmatic and strategic.
I'm just going to ask you to unpack materialistic, because some people will see that as a slur, but you don't mean it in that.
No,
those
I don't mean it as a slur. I don't mean it as a slur. I sort of mean it in the sort of political science sense, which is, before, you know, basically the 60s or 70s, politics used to be materialistic, i.e. it was about wages, it was about, you know, things you could really kind of touch, basically.
Yeah, outcomes.
Yeah, real outcomes, you know. And that's not to, I don't mean that. I mean that physical outcomes, you know, is really what I mean, things you can touch. And then, you know, the post-material revolution kind of happened, and this is what we associate with all the social movements that have sort of shaped our modern world. So, you know, feminism, the gay rights movement, the environmental movement, the consumer rights movement, privacy movements, all of these movements, which, and you can kind of see why they're called post-material, because they're often things that are abstract legal frameworks or rights that unlock potential, not necessarily always things that you can kind of touch, like the public hospital, the school that your child attends, the, you know, the house that you live in.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and it is interesting, Band, in that regard. I've written about this a few times and in fact, changed some of my thinking about it as I've done so, because I think when Band first became leader, I was asked by, I think it was a conversation, to think about and predict what kind of leader he would be. And at that stage, I was thinking of him as, you know, very much a kind of a firebrand. He was, he's a very skilled communicator. He knows how to stay on message and he hits all the marks, but he doesn't, and he didn't strike me at the time as someone who was big on the idea of compromise. He was very sort of committed to his path. I think what we've actually seen since then, and I've sort of written about it again for the conversation, what we've seen since then is a different kind of political leader for the Greens, as you say. He understands the politics very well, and he reads that, he plays that game quite well. But at the same time, he also knows that how you position and what you get is important. So if we look at that matter you thought about then, referred to the on the climate change question, on policy in that regard, the Labor government was strongly kind of positioning the Greens, or trying to sort of corner them on the question and say, are you going to redo what you did in 2009 and block the CPRS, the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme, and result being that you end up with no policy, right? Mm-hmm. Or you end up with the carbon tax that we eventually had, but which was ultimately
repealed.
Yeah, right? It was ultimately repealed because the circumstances in which it came about were so incredibly sort of, stressed, really, and toxic and contested. So when Greens supporters say to me, oh, well, you know, they didn't just block the CPRS, they established a carbon price. Yes, they did. But the circumstances of that were doomed almost from the beginning in a political sense. And you can almost draw a sort of a causal line between that crisis and the emergence of Tony Abbott and therefore things that happened thereafter.
Yes.
And Bant obviously didn't want to go back into that territory. So he did reach an agreement with the government on climate policy.
Yeah.
But he did so in such a way that he was also, you know, messaging very clearly to his own side. You know, at the same time as he was doing a deal with the government, he was lambasting them, saying that they are in the pocket of the oil and gas industry, you know, completely sort of drunk on the support that they get from that industry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple of important things here. Like, I think Labor has been incredibly successful at blaming the Greens for their own failure around carbon pricing. I mean, they were the government. Could have gone to a double D on it. They didn't.
Yeah.
So there's
in
that.
2010, you mean?
That's right. Exactly. And, you know, and that was the end of Rudd's prime ministership. We can draw a causal line there too, right?
You can,
so there's that. I mean, I think what is really interesting about this is that ultimately he's been able to take his party room with him. They have had to do a deal on this climate stuff because, as they rightly kind of say, you know, the future of the species is kind of at stake. And so, therefore, they've doubled down on housing. This is their point of differentiation.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is where they're creating space.
They are, and we hear this from Max Chandler-Mather, the young Greens housing spokesperson. He's talking about a third of the population, of the adult population, the renting, and saying, you know, who represents them? Well, these are all interesting issues for the expanded crossbench, of which the Greens, of course, had a radical expansion. They had, you know, they just had Adam Band in the lower house before the last election. Now they've got three more, which has also, I think, had an impact upon the way that they are conducting their politics. But someone else who was on in that crossbench is Allegra Spender, the member for Wentworth, and I'm very glad to say that she joins us here on Democracy Sausage. Welcome to the trestle table.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really good to have you here. What's it like in the crossbench? Is it you're all one big happy family, or is it balkanized? Is there tension?
Now, look, to be honest, I think it's very constructive. You know, I've came
I've come from business and the not-for-profit sector, and I'm used to, you know, working with people, you know, within your organisation, with other organisations, and you're always trying to find common ground.
Yeah, that's so you're collaborating with people who have different interests but also shared interests.
Shared interests. And I think that – and that's how I really approach the crossbench, and I think that's how a lot of the crossbench approach it, saying, look, you know, we're here to do a job, and that job is to, you know, make this parliament deliver for the Australian people. And that's the most important job that we're here for. And therefore, you know, you see different issues, you have different opinions about things, but I think I'm willing to work with anyone on the crossbench, both the House and the Senate, because I think my job is there to make good things happen, and I work also across the, you know, with the major parties as well. And that's really the approach. So, you know, working with the crossbench so far has been a real pleasure, because I think most people, they're in a very constructive space.
Yeah. So there's some level of coordination. I mean, one of the things, I guess we want to be really careful about how we describe this, because one of the criticisms, particularly the Libs tried to make against all of the teal independents, and I see you've got a lovely teal scarf on there, against the independents in the lead up to the election, when they were, you know, fighting for their strongholds, that they, you know, their liberal jewels that they saw as their birthright almost,
yes. was
that, you know, these teals were frauds. I mean, that they were working together, that they were sort of a quasi party, that they were, you know, being manipulated by Simon Holmes at court and so forth. So has that been, you know, that was a sort of a slur that, you know, luckily voters rejected, because I always knew that was nonsense, and I wrote so a number of times. But has that kind of, you know, getting past that, getting into parliament, has it then been an issue in people's minds not to be seen to be a party, or is it does it just naturally not occur?
Look, it's not an issue really for me, you know, and I think you can see it pretty clearly in our voting records, to be honest. We don't all vote the same, and it's because we have different communities and different views. But, you know, I always say, you know, the coalition can't have it both ways. They can't, you know, on the one side they said, oh, you know, all these independents, it'll be chaos, and they're a party. And I think what we've shown is both those things aren't true.
Yeah.
That you can work very constructively together and, you know, be very constructive force, I think, in the parliament. And that's how I see it. And, you know, with the Simon Holmes Court piece, I always say, I'm a 45-year-old woman. I don't need to be told what to do by, you know, man pulling my strings. You know, I've got enough, you know, I've got enough on my plate to, and, you know, I'm here because I want to really do a good job.
Maria, that always struck me. I mean, the point Allegra makes there about that gender aspect, it was really strong to me even at the time, you know, that most of these candidates were women, professional women, people who had made their lives, done successful things in their careers, and were stepping into the public space, stepping forward, putting their names up for election. And a lot of the criticism did have that kind of undertone of, you know, these people are just, you know, puppets, they're just being manipulated.
It's a really revealing, I think, moment for the Liberal Party. You know, like, there's that sort of hack phrase about good writing, you know, show don't tell. Well, I mean, I think they kind of did both simultaneously in doing that. And if you look at the post-election wash up, it's pretty clear that they actually really didn't understand the problem set that they were actually facing. I think that they struggled to actually include a lot of the teal seats in their overnight tracking because they were traditionally safe seats, and so they were really blindsided on the night. Perhaps not the people on the ground, like the actual individual candidates who probably were cognizant of that, but it sort of goes to show how information and power is distributed in that party, that was such a shock.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned the housing issue, the Housing Australia Future Fund, for example, which is stalled between, with that standoff with the Greens and the Coalition. Allegra, you've recently been talking about the idea of a citizens' assembly for getting past these kinds of political deadlocks, I suppose, these policies that just stall, where the machine itself, as it is currently configured, that being Parliament and the political parties and the interests they represent, that it sort of grinds to a halt, that you get the standoff. And you're talking about a way of unlocking alternative pathways forward. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. Look, the idea of a citizens' assembly is about randomly selecting people from across the community, you know, in this case a country, but can be and has been used successfully, you know, in at the council, local government and state level in Australia already. And it's bringing those people together and saying, giving them a very specific problem and saying, you know, can you come up with a consensus view of at least 80% of people in the room with solutions to this challenge? And you know, you've seen this in Ireland. They use this around legalization of abortion. Mm-hmm. You see this in France. Macron, the president, commissioned one of these citizens' assemblies to use this on climate action and how France should address climate change. And you see this, you know, the city of Melbourne, for example, used it on how to deal with a significant budget deficit that the council had got into a political, were politically stuck in terms of the options moving forward. And so I think it's bringing that group of people together and going for consensus, I think, is a great opportunity of bringing forward solutions that are not typically on the table for major political parties in particular, but also you know, bringing the Australian community with them, because it's real people not playing for political interests, not looking, you know, for example, in the housing, you know, future fund that we're seeing right now, where this is a political contest. There's no contest between the Greens and Labor that they don't support social housing. They both do. This is a political brinkmanship about who's, you know, how far they can push this. And frankly, I sat there yesterday in the press conference with all these different housing groups who are saying, we've got houses ready to go, can you please pass this bill? And so that's the frustration. And what I'm trying to do is block that, not just for social housing, but for housing affordability in Australia more broadly.
Yeah, you're right. It's a fascinating moment in the sense, but an all too standard one, really, where we see political parties adopt a position, and then through pride and I guess calculations about, you know, what damage they would suffer electorally, they refuse to negotiate. Now, the government's obviously decided this is the way forward for this social and affordable housing. The HAF, the Housing Australia Future Fund, would put $10 billion into a fund. That fund would earn money. This is that sort of way future funds work. That fund would earn an income, and from that income there would be expenditure on social and affordable housing, 30,000 housing units, I think, over 5 years, is it? It's, you know, not an insignificant number, but when you consider the scale of the problem in Australia, it's also well short of demand. And of course, we hear all the time that supply is the problem here. So this is a sort of a multi-level problem. It's worse in some parts of the country than others, but it affects people who are least well equipped to handle it. And it needs to be addressed. The Greens have a very significant point, I think, in saying it doesn't go far enough. They initially were saying they want 10 times. So the government's proposing up to $500 million, that is income from that $10 billion, would be spent on social and affordable housing per year, right? The Greens are saying, no, it has to be, well, initially they said 10 times that amount. So they were looking for $5 billion of expenditure. They've now changed that to 2.5. They say they have moved, but the government hasn't. The government's now, I think, changed what was up to $500 million. They now call it a floor, so they would spend that at least, but it's probably also a ceiling from what I can tell from reading their words. Either way, we're not anywhere at the moment in sort of moving forward on this. There is the $2 billion I mentioned that sort of came out of nowhere on the weekend, which is very welcome, no doubt, but it's separate from this. Take your idea forward. Let's assume for a moment that you've got the Citizens Assembly up. They deliberate on this over a period of time. They come up with a solution. What happens then? I mean, because it's not deliberative in the sense. I mean, or at least it's not decision making in the way government is, right? At the end of the day, it still has to either be agreed with, adopted, or not.
I think that's absolutely right, and that's how it's worked in other jurisdictions, and you know, in France and Ireland, and also, you know, in Australia to date. It doesn't bind government, but it advises government. And I think, you know, when I look at housing, I think it's to be honest, Australian housing affordability in this country is broken. This is failed policy, you know, for the last 20 years at sort of federal, state, local levels. It has been something that, you know, I think all the governments to date are culpable
palpable for the impact of what this is having on communities now. It's a long-term problem and it's going to take a long time to solve. And I think that we need to be honest about the scale of change that we will need to deal with housing effectively in this country, so that, you know, people who are working hard, you know, have a fair chance of being able to afford a house near where they work without relying on their parents, because not everyone can rely on their parents, and that's not the Australian dream, you know, to always say, well, let me rely on my parents to be able to do this. And so what I think a Citizens Assembly on Housing Affordability does or has the option to do is actually expand the option set for what we should be considering. And it would deliberately include owners, renters, and mortgage holders, you know, including also investors in property. So you challenge, you know, and because you have to come up with consensus, but people also have to listen to the experts. So they have an expert briefing, but then have a whole series of experts who come in. That's a chance for everyday people to come up and say, well, we all have different interests here, but we have a shared view in this country, which is that everyone in this country should be able to afford housing. And this is our consensus view that deals with some of those political trade-offs, because I think that politics often isn't able, you know, with the wedging that goes on, particularly with the major parties, there's a failure to sort of face some of the political trade-offs. You know, we've got to a culture where no one can be worse off. And frankly, sometimes things have to change, and, you know, but they can change for the good of the country. And so I think that's really important for me. As that's the reason why I think this is a really good way of unlocking a difficult problem. But just, you know, again, the government doesn't have to adopt all the recommendations, but it does give them an insight to what also not the sort of focus group, not the sort of loud people saying, what actually ordinary citizens from across the country are saying.
Let's take a quick break there and be back in a moment.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. You're with Democracy Sausage, which comes to you each week from the Australian National University. I'm with Allegra Spender and, of course, Dr. Maria Tafaga, who is with us each week. And we were talking just then about, you know, this mechanism of using citizens' assemblies for these complex policy problems. You made a really good point there, Allegra, about many good points, but among them, the point about, you know, the implication that sometimes some people are going to lose something out of policy. You know, if you've got a distribution problem, an unfairness problem, an access problem, people are being denied basic human rights like housing, then changes need to be made. Now, we know many people in Australia who are well off own more than one house. There are people who have multiple rental properties. There are people who have beach houses that are, you know, spend only a small amount of time occupied. There are people who live in enormous houses, probably many people in Wentworth, actually, now that I think about it. In fact, I think Wentworth is, I don't know if this is still the case, but it used to be the wealthiest electorate in Australia. I remember looking at that.
It's one of the wealthiest, but interestingly, on housing, we have 60% of our community live in flats and apartments.
Yeah.
And only about less than 20% actually live in a sort of freestanding house. So it's wealthy, and there are also high proportion of renters. So around 40% of the community rents, again, which is much higher. It's higher than the community. So it's more nuanced, I think, than anybody really recognises.
Yeah. And that's a very good point. And I actually know that because I've been a renter there myself. But nonetheless, it's really sort of fascinating, this idea that political parties need to find a way to sometimes confront these problems which have grown up. We subsidize housing in this country, that is home ownership, in an extraordinary way through negative gearing, through capital gains tax concessions, these kinds of things. Housing has been sort of preferenced, right, as an investment vehicle. And this is been great for sort of the boomer generation that have done well out of it, but for those coming afterwards, it's presenting a bigger and bigger structural problem. So yeah, I'm really fascinated by the extent to which, and perhaps Marie, you might have a view on this as well, the extent to which a mechanism like citizens' assemblies could provide not just the kind of a different intellectual kind of resource and perspective on complex policy problems, but in a sense the political permission, the sort of the escape from the current thinking that political parties might do. They have the authority of this body of citizens that are not vested interests, that don't represent lobby groups or investors or even perhaps one single set of people, but you know, is a cross section, and this can provide political parties with some sort of escape clause from their current position.
Yeah, and that's exactly how these assemblies have been used in the past. Like, so if we look to the Irish case in the first instance, the reason why it was put to a citizens' assembly, the issue of abortion, was simply because the issue could not be resolved by the political system, right? It had completely broken down.
Mm.
And then, you know, that had worked so effectively in part because of some of the things Allegra kind of said. It's a structured long-form discussion, right?
Yep.
So it's actually a discussion that happens over multiple iterations over time. So people have time to think. It's usually carefully curated and managed by basically neutral bureaucrats who essentially make sure that the full spectrum of opinion is represented.
Because and there's quite a literature on this, isn't there,
yes.
That exists. And some of the world's best experts in citizens' assemblies are actually in Australia. People like John Dreiser.
That's right, over at UC.
Yeah,
yes, that's
yeah.
right. We should get him on.
Mark Evans as well.
That's right. Yeah, they Del Webb.
Both
and
professors.
So on.
Yes, Del
Webb. Nicole
yeah.
Curato, Selene, whose last name is now escaping me. I know, but yeah, that's right. So yeah, I think citizens' assemblies are a great idea. I mean, I'm actually a little bit even more radical. Like, there's this talk about increasing the size of the lower house. Well, I mean, if it was up to me, that I would also give a portion of the Senate seats over to a sortition model, which is essentially permanently putting in everyday citizens into the Senate, because it's probably realistically the only way to get ordinary citizens into politics without a Simon Holmes Court to sort of help seed some of these community kind of groups and actions from below.
I'm just going to ask you to explain the term sortition.
What is sortition? Mm. Sortition is basically jury duty for politics.
Yes.
So the idea is that you essentially select randomly from the population, but you'd need a couple of guardrails around it. Like, one, you'd actually really need to offer incoming, like effectively amateur politicians, like a lot of training, because otherwise they can kind of be picked off by the major parties. The second is that you need to think carefully about how long the terms are, because it's obviously going to be quite disruptive to these people's lives. And then they actually need a decent pension, because sometimes people can't get a job after being in politics. And if you're basically press ganged into it, you kind of need a security of income after the fact, right?
What a great job it must be. You can't get another job after it.
Well, there was actually a study done about the Victorian Parliament about the post-parliamentary lives of politicians. And I mean, you know, there's obviously the cases that we know about, you know, such and such has gone on to lobby for X company and so on. But then there are people who have literally ended up homeless. So it's actually non-trivial. So to get back to the actual issue at hand, which is citizens' assembly around housing. So I think these are generally very good ideas, but the only thing that really concerns me about starting with something like housing is that housing is such a, it's got a lot of vested interests,
yeah.
right? And it's also got a lot of decision points or, you know, veto points. And that would be my concern around a citizens' assembly, is that if the political system is learning how to use them on an issue like housing, which is really complicated because of the multi-level of government problem that you yourself as highlighted, I kind of worry that that the recommendations will be in effect difficult to implement because it's actually not clear who's necessarily responsible.
So we're proposing that it would be focused on what is the federal government's role in this, not what is every government's role in this. And you're absolutely right that it's a tricky issue. But I think if you focus on the federal government, what are their levers to pull, then I think you can make that easier. But I think the fact that it's got vested interests actually makes it a really good topic because I think there are a lot of, you know, as a politician, I notice it's the loud people you hear. What I'm always trying to do, and particularly as a community independent, is speak to the people who, you know, who don't think to write to me, who don't, you know, who aren't engaged, but have, you know, thoughtful opinions, but they're too busy running their lives, raising their kids, you know, working, you know, doing their jobs. And I think that is actually the opportunity a Citizens Assembly presents, is getting those people to be part of the conversation. Because I think Australians are very reasonable people. You know, we're very constructive. You see that in our community engagement in how we build our communities. We're people who actually, we want to find common ground with people. We want to build things with people. You know, we take people as they are. But we, you know, with politics can really sort of is sort of by nature, you know, driven by conflict. Media is interested in conflict, and this is the antidote to this. This is about trying to bring consensus in there and then challenging the political class to say, you know, if we can come up as a group of ordinary Australians, come up with consensus, you know, why can't you, you know, try and rise to that challenge as well?
Yeah, because what it effectively does is break down the sort of zero-sum thinking, which is where housing politics has kind of arrived, right, which is why the policies you get don't actually do anything and just sort of pour petrol onto the fire.
Look, I think in housing policy is a situation where people have been saying, you know, announcing housing policies where it sounds good and is in fact actually desperately bad for Australian housing affordability.
So things like first home buyers grants and so forth, which in fact just add to demand and which also therefore push up prices.
Yeah,
you know, so people are rolling up at auctions or signing contracts for new builds armed with money they've got from the federal government, and this results in the entry price for housing going up.
Yeah. And I think that is the worst sort of politics, and there's a worse sort of political outcome, but we get time and time again, which is sounds good, costs the taxpayer money, and actually is, you know, in best case is does nothing, in worst case often makes the issue actually worse. And that's where the failure's been in housing.
This is one of the government's arguments, and a number of other people, not just the government, arguments against the Greens' rental freeze idea, that this would have perverse effects in the market, ultimately would reduce in a reduction of supply.
Yeah. And look, I've looked at research around this. The Brookings Institute did some really good work on looking at the sort of a history of different sort of rent freezes, and that's what they find. It sort of leads to sort of gentrification, reduces supply, and also lower quality of housing because landlords aren't incentivized to, you know, to upgrade, you know, the plumbing or invest in their housing stock. And so but again, it's a policy that sounds good, but is potentially, you know, very detrimental to actually the problem that we're trying to solve. And I think that's what you want a Citizens Assembly to do is to be able to interrogate the evidence, to be able to listen to experts, to listen to people with lived experience, but then have to come to a consensus and, you know, again, balancing all the different interests and the different types of people that we have in the country.
It's interesting though, like when you think about it from the Greens' perspective, like you say, it might not stand up to rigorous analysis, this idea of a rent freeze, but the messaging is about a political party speaking to a group of people, a significant slice of people, particularly young people who are locked out of home ownership, who don't even really aspire to it in many cases because it seems so unrealistic, so far off. And they now have a political party that is overtly and directly saying, we represent you, we are going to push your interests. Because implicit right through our political logic in this country has been, you used the term before yourself, the Australian dream, you know, the idea of home ownership. Mm. And for a lot of people, a lot of quite highly educated people, people at this university, people who've been through universities, people who have, you know, professional qualifications, who don't see home ownership as possible. And they now see a party saying, we represent you. We're going to be the party of renters. I think it's, you know, it's a pretty clever strategy.
It's politically powerful, but my real concern is, you know, I've got friends who are in that situation who don't believe, you know, they can ever buy their own home. I've got so many people in Wentworth, you know, who either move out, you know, I've got parents who have benefited from sort of the growth in housing, you know, value over time, who are going, I don't know how my kids are ever going to be able to, you know, buy a house, or, you know, how are they going to pay their rent without me sort of helping them?
And or dying.
So, yeah, and, yeah, and it's exactly, yeah, yeah. And it's across the country. And I just think it's so unfair. But I'm fearful of you know, policies that sound good,
yeah,
that could make this worse. And that's why I think, you know, we do need to look at the evidence. We need to move beyond that, you know, that sort of policy bias of survey. Because, and the reason why I got interested in Citizens Assembly in the first place was because I've always been interested in policy, but I didn't, you know, I just was like, how can I be across so many different issues and be really across them? And, you know, you see in all the sort of political sort of surveys, you know, people give their instinctive reaction to policies because, frankly, we're all on, everyone's got something else to do with their lives apart from analysing the policy. But I think that this is what citizens' assemblies do, give people a chance to really go into the detail, to make very informed decisions and then feed back into the political process rather than, you know, the sort of consulting or other pieces which, you know, people just give their sort of, you know, immediate gut reaction rather than that reaction based on the evidence.
Which is often actually how the question is asked will often shape the answer as well, right? If you ask people, oh, does everyone have a right to a home? Everyone will say yes, yeah. You know, because it's the equivalent of do mothers love their babies, yeah. Right? But then, you know, if you start asking about the tax treatment of things, then you obviously get a different set of answers again. And I think that's the issue around, like, even if we just look at housing from the sort of federal government's perspective, it is actually quite complicated. And it is, from a policy perspective, interesting that actually over time, like, we've had this conversation around sovereign wealth funds, which have never gone anywhere, but we are actually kind of doing that slowly. Like, we keep setting up these sort of funds and these sort of instruments, and it goes back to previous, I suppose, implementation failures. So I think the Rudd government was interested in incentivizing private investment in the housing market through sort of tax deductions. And I think there was a lot of work done with the then minister that I think was Plibersek, with the sort of groups about exactly how to organize it and how to set it up so it would work well. And then it went to the sort of political office and it was sort of changed because in a sort of utopia style moment or a Holloman moment, right? Like, we need a bigger number, you know, we need it to,
that's not very exciting.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. And so therefore it didn't really meet the goals, right? Or the hype, because it was not designed to do that. I mean, I think that's why I would be quite interested to see such a citizens assembly kind of come up, because we have had, like, this is a really long-winded way of saying, like, we've had a lot of layering in this policy domain, and the reality is that it actually requires several big changes. Like, it requires a significant amount of government investment because there has been a gross underinvestment, right? And then it also requires a big changes to the tax treatment of this asset.
Lay the problem. This is part of the sort of that we referred to earlier, the political machine. It's been incapable of addressing this problem because the major political parties, neither of the two major political sides, want to be responsible for a reduction in housing values. I mean, we see a reduction at the moment arising from, you know, punishing interest rates, but essentially governments don't want to, you know, most people's prime asset is their home, and they get wealthier over time as a result of the appreciation of that asset. That's the general trajectory. And governments don't want to tinker with that. It's, you know, like,
well,
you said,
it's emotional, Australian, right?
Well, it's financial. But the problem is, if you're not prepared to do that, then you are not going to get redistribution in this market.
Well, that's
finite
correct,
supply, right? A finite supply of houses and increasing demand. And, you know, you can try and get these things in balance. But if you're hamstrung by not being prepared to touch the policy architecture which favours those who already hold houses, and to the point where they can become bidders and drive up the price for second and third and fourth houses and so forth, then, you know, you're not getting to the problem.
Look, I'm just saying, I think that, you know, I always come back to, what does the community want? Community wants everyone to be able to afford to, you know, to have you know, secure home, housing. And also I think a chance to buy their house over time. You know, I don't think also the community wants any sort of radical changes, but these things won't happen quickly. But, you know, we do absolutely need to address supply. I think that is absolutely critical. I think the government's right, to be honest, in identifying that, but they're not bold enough, to be honest, in doing anything about it. And that's what I... it's that urgency that I think the community can help the government see how urgent an issue it is in our country that people can't do this and how I think it's a very serious threat to, you know, our absolutely wonderful democracy, which is imperfect but still thriving compared to almost anyone around the world. If people feel completely shut out, from affordable housing in their future, and so I think this is
that's super the contract, critical. Isn't it? I mean, you may not have a house now, but if you have a realistic prospect of getting one, getting ahead, and so forth, then you have an investment in the system. Yeah. I don't mean just a financial investment, but a life investment, a sort of a social, psychological investment. But if you don't, what is your stake in the maintenance of the system? And we've seen the results of that in the US, where Kim Beazley, who I was talking about before, I remember him making this point when he came back from being the US ambassador, and he was making the point that there hadn't been a wage rise in the US at that stage since the 1970s, a real wage rise for working people. And we see the results of that in the rise of Trumpism and alienation and the sense of utter distrust in the political system in Washington and so forth. So this is really corrosive, potentially, if we have a large section of our population who are just being told, no, you're not part of this story.
Mm.
I want to go to what your assessment is of where the government's at on this suggestion, because I saw you the other day ask a question of the PM, and he stood up and he was generous enough and all that, but then he made this point. He said, but I have always regarded this house as – 151 member Citizens Assembly.
Yeah, look, I mean, I say, if I'd had a right of reply, I would have said, well, this House has failed the Australian people for the last 20 years on housing. So, I want to try a different one. And I think
that's... Is anyone saying anything to you?
I think this is going to be a bit of a long game. And for me, the goal is to engage them on this and to engage across the Parliament, because this is no threat to the government's authority. This is no threat to the House of... reps. This is a chance to actually have a more thoughtful conversation about housing, and I think it's actually in all the major parties' political interest, as well as in the national interest.
Yeah, because it could provide them with sort of out. And I suppose exactly in the context of the the PwC scandal and the attention that is brought on the way governments, Maria, rely so heavily on consultants, this is another form of advice to them, but free of all that taint of all of profiteering. Getting a genuine cross-section of the community to wrestle with so-called wicked problems, lot to be said for it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think where its potential really kind of lies is in the sort of emotion and the imagination of the community, because as we've sort of been saying, right, this is an emotional touchstone. It's sort of how people see themselves as being members of our community, but there are actually many ways to belong, right? Like, it doesn't all have to gear towards home ownership. Mm. Like, we could decide to become a society of renters and give renters rights, like significantly different kinds of rights. So it doesn't have to be about home ownership. I mean, but we are a home ownership society, and so therefore not being able to own one is emotionally so difficult. And I don't mean that to sort of say, oh, it's emotional and not rational and therefore it's not good. No. What I am saying is that most people change their minds basically on emotional calculi, which is essentially what these citizens' assemblies in Ireland on abortion and gay rights were able to do. They were able to shift the emotional way that people understood the issue and move them out of one set of thinking into another. And I think that's actually where a citizens' assembly has the biggest kind of potential, because you've sort of made the point, Mark, and so have you actually, Allegra. We actually know how to fix this problem. It's not a lack of expertise. It's a problem that politicians think they have about convincing people. And so this is a vehicle, an education vehicle that could be quite useful to them, right? You know, like I thought it was really interesting that Peter Dutton said he wanted Australians to think of the Liberal Party and the jingling of house keys when they voted, and his solution was for young people to spend their retirement income savings on buying a house. And it's just like that's not the image you want to be putting in people's minds, you know? Yeah.
He obviously does.
Look, I think this is an opportunity both for the emotional but also for the rational. And and I'll use a city of Melbourne as an example, because that was a very rational issue where they had the city had a $1.2 billion deficit going forward, and they basically the council couldn't agree should they increase rates, should they sell assets, or should they stop spending money that they'd promised. And they had just reached an impasse. And that's what the Citizens Assembly did, was they actually identified, I think, a $900 million worth of changes, including some changes to rates, some selling of assets, and some reduction of programs, which is probably the rational response to that. But the ones that the councillors admit that they just couldn't even have the conversation because of the potential for political wedging. So I think this is a very emotional issue for Australia, and 100% agree with you. It goes to the heart of, you know, of what it is to Australian, and I think to the idea of a fair go, and I think this is the opportunity to combine the emotional and the rational, and to also discount challenges like the you know, this idea of freezing rents, which emotionally appeals, but rationally, you know, is I think actually much more of a dangerous policy. So that's why I like it, because I think it can engage both.
Yeah, I think it's really well put. I think the potential is to get those two things together, and perhaps to challenge some of our kind of that, you know, the power of that myth, you know, the Australian dream, the power of that as a sort of a trope from which we are, you know, might need to escape or reinterpret in such a way that actually is more inclusive, because its original intent was about inclusion, but it's now become exclusionary for so many people. And we have it, we see it in policies like negative gearing, where landlords are subsidised by the taxpayer for making a loss, right? So that means that they can rent out a property, and their losses they can count against their taxable income. That effectively is a subsidy. Now, would that be better going to renters rather than going to investors in those homes? There's an argument, there's a discussion to be had around those sorts of questions, and that goes to your point, Maria, before about whether we just have to be homeowners or whether we might actually shift our thinking and be long-term renters, like in so many European countries and even in you know, New York and places like that.
And look, I will raise negative gearing, because I think, you know, from the evidence I've looked at, even reducing negative gearing would not have a significant impact on house prices. But so I think I look at negative gearing more of a tax question, to be honest, and what should the tax system look like, rather than perhaps as much of a housing policy. But I think the
politically,
truth is that
though, it's a third rail,
political,
isn't it?
It's on politically, it's what, when people think of housing policy, they go straight to negative gearing. And I think that's where, again, having this conversation, saying, look, how big an impact it is, how serious, you know, is this, should we be considering it? All these options should be on the table. And I do trust the Australian, you know, populace to come up with some thoughtful recommendations. And then the government of the day can, of course, choose what they go forward with. So I agree very much with the PwC. We spend a lot of money on consultants. This is another type of consulting, but I think is likely to be much more powerful.
Yeah. So we could move from negative gearing and past negative hearing and onto something else.
Onto something else.
Yeah, something better. Allegra Spender, thanks for being with us on Democracy Sausage. It's been absolutely terrific to have you along, coming across the frozen lake this morning.
Yes, it's very cold this morning.
Bitterly cold. -4, I think, as cold as I've, pretty much as cold as I've seen in Canberra in many years.
It's been a while since it's been this cold.
Yeah. Thanks, Maria.
Pleasure.
That's Democracy Sausage for this week. We'll look forward to talking to you again from the studio at ANU. You can contact us in the meantime on our email, which is democracysausage, or one word, @anu.edu.au. We look forward to hearing from you, get your feedback there, and you can, of course, subscribe to the podcast, leave a rating should you so desire. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week, when we'll be dealing with some other interesting and thorny political or policy or both problems. Bye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.